Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Philip Coggan, the Buttonwood columnist, and this is Money Talks. Coming up in the show, Ukraine's finance minister joins us to discuss the beleaguered country's reform program.
Where can you find even a minute to say, listen, we have time now to relax? I don't see it in my life.
And how, on the inside, banks are starting to look more like software companies.
They are concentrating very, very hard on getting products out very quickly. So you get a team together within a few days, you get a prototype together within 6 weeks, you're meant to have a product ready for the customer's hands within 9 months.
But first,
ekonomisk vetenskap till Alfred Nobels minne för år 2017 till Richard H. Thaler.
This week, the economist Richard Thaler was announced as the winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Economics. Mr. Thaler was given the award for his contribution to behavioral economics, a field that explores how psychology affects economic decision making. We interviewed Mr. Thaler last year on The Economist Asks, and here's a little clip from that.
Sure, there may be some Larry Summers or Joe Stiglitz among the people being nudged, but they can ignore it. And the rest of us probably need a little help in figuring out how much we need to save for retirement and what would be the best way to do it.
Ryan Avent, our free exchange columnist, is writing about him in this week's issue and is on the line from Washington. Ryan, Mr. Thaler's best known for the nudge theory. Could we explain that?
So the upshot of a lot of Richard Thaler's work is that people make decisions as best they can given cognitive limitations, which is not what most economists generally assume. They kind of assume that to some extent people are somewhat superhuman and have better information than anyone could have and are more rational and calculating than anyone actually is. And Thaler showed in a lot of different ways that people use different heuristics or kind of rules of thumb to make decisions. And in particular, they often make decisions based on some sort of reference point that is set in their minds that can be suggested to them or that is perhaps based on an experience they've had in the past. So if they buy a stock, the sort of place where they buy is a reference point in their mind, and they're going to be reluctant to sell while the price is below that because they don't want to lock in that loss. What nudge theory is all about is essentially using those sorts of reference points to kind of encourage people to make better decisions without actually limiting their choice. So a simple way to talk about it is to look at contributions to pension plans. It had normally been the case before Thaler's work that the default would be that people are not enrolled in pension plans. That would be sort of the reference point, and they would have to use their own willpower to kind of get themselves to enroll in it. Nudge theory simply said, well, if you make it so that the default is that people are opted in, and that's the reference point, that's the status quo, then they'll be much more likely to stay in and to save more. And of course, that ended up happening.
Britain has done that, of course. I'm just interested if, has the theory been applied in America very much, where there is a nudge unit, isn't there?
So the book Nudge that Richard Thaler wrote was co-written with Cass Sunstein. And Cass Sunstein was, for a while, an advisor in the White House to President Barack Obama. Barack Obama asked people in the White House to consider seeing how these techniques could be used to improve regulatory policy and other things. That was sort of a short-lived experiment. I believe it went out the door with him. There's been more of a permanent institutional change in the UK where they had the nudge unit there, which has since been turned into a public-private partnership, but which continues to kind of study ways to help people make better choices.
I think one of the things they do is I'm not sure it's in the US or the UK, is to write to people to tell them that their neighbours tend to pay their taxes on time. And this has been shown to encourage people to pay their own taxes on time. Isn't that right?
That's exactly right. And that's another example of sort of setting a reference point in a way that makes people think, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. that way of reframing the issue makes it easier for people to sort of exercise the willpower they need to behave in a particular way.
Now, as good journalists, we'll know that three things define a trend. So we've had Daniel Kahneman win the prize, we've had Robert Shiller win the prize, and now Thaler. So do you think that behavioral economics is now mainstream thinking as far as the sector is concerned?
Well, the Nobel Committee surely seems to think so. No, I think actually it really has become quite mainstream to the point where it's almost not clear that we really need to continue to have a behavioral economics. Behavioral economics is really just economics. And I guess what I mean by that is that for a long time, economists really were engaged in this project of trying to be a bit like physicists and to say, well, if we have a few simple rules for how people behave, then we can build these models of the economy that work really well. What the behavioral economists showed is that those simple rules just fail in lots of ways systematically. And so this kind of project, at least given what we know about people now, is not going to be possible. What people are really doing now, to an increasing extent, is going to the data saying, here's a very specific policy question. Let's see what humans do, and let's see what the data shows us, rather than saying we're going to build grand theories of human behavior. So it's been a really influential science, almost to the point where it's made itself obsolete.
And interestingly, economists are studying sort of real-world problems, right? So the freakonomic stuff, you know, people are getting into the weeds and looking at the minutiae of how individual policies work and how people react.
That's right, and in a lot of very useful ways. And I think we've seen some really good examples of this over the last few years, where people are very focused on, you know, what do particular programs that try to improve access to good schools do? Or what happens when a particular city faces an increase in you know, Chinese import penetration? And they're really kind of targeted questions that economists are asking, you know, in the hopes of contributing some useful knowledge rather than just some elegant, you know, mathematics in a paper.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Well, if you have any thoughts about behavioral economics, get in touch. Indeed, in the spirit of Mr. Thaler, most people that you know have probably got in touch with The Economist about our podcast. So please contact us via Twitter at Economist Radio or email us at radio@economist.com. Next. After the annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the outbreak of a Russian-backed insurgency in eastern regions, Ukraine fell into a recession. It was rescued by the IMF and has now largely stabilized, even starting to issue bonds again on the international markets. So does the future look promising, and what hurdles are there still to overcome? Callum Williams, our Britain economics correspondent, sat down with Oleksandr Danylyuk, Ukraine's finance minister. He started by asking about the biggest reform achievements the government has made to Ukraine's economy in the past few years.
Last week, we adopted the pension reform. It's actually custom designed for Ukraine to address not only the deficit, but also the long-term social sustainability. If you ask a year ago, people didn't believe that we will ever be able to do this. This actually just restores the trust that this government, you know, is able to pass a very difficult reforms. Second is cleaning up of the banking system. Around 90 banks were moved, removed from the market because they were not feasible. And part of this banking sector cleanup was nationalization of private bank.
So one of the criticisms of the pension reform is that the methods that have been used to reach the final agreement were somewhat different from what had been agreed with the IMF. And many of the recommendations are not going to come in force until after the presidential elections in 2019. What would you say in response to those two particular criticisms, which essentially say that the pension reform has been somewhat watered down from what was intended at first?
That's not the case. We drafted this reform together with Minister of Finance, Ministry of Social Affairs, but we work together with IMF and World Bank.
So the IMF are totally on board with this new reform?
This is a joint product, right? There were some amendments proposed, well, not that many, you know, 2,142 amendments between first and second reading. So obviously some of these amendments could have been very harmful. And IMF just highlighted that we have concerns about this, and this. By the way, we also had concerns about this. During the final adoption, we managed to neutralize such amendments. They were not included into the law. And I believe we now have a pension reform which is fully compatible.
Is there a particular part of the reform agenda that you think is going too slowly?
Yes. One, which is especially harmful, is reforming the law enforcement system. You know, we're building a market economy for the last 26 years. We're improving the market condition, boosting competitions, you know, improving business climate. But the law enforcement remained in 20th century. It's a Soviet system when actually the doing business sounds dodgy. The people don't get that actually business pay taxes, business create employment. And we as a government should do everything possible to support businesses. And that is cannot be done just overnight saying like, we love business. People need to change these institutions. Their mandate needs to change. Mm-hmm. And all overlap between the existing institution also needs to be eliminated. Our plan is to introduce the new law enforcement, financial police, very compact, effective institution. They will fight the economic crimes against the state, but also they will not harass the business.
And what about the status of the special anti-corruption courts that the president has been talking about in recent years? Do you have a sense of when these courts are going to actually be functional, day-to-day courts that are prosecuting people and taking cases and so on? Do you have a sense of date?
Plans is to launch it next year. It's very important. Like financial police, we're planning to do it from scratch, hire new people. Same with National Anti-Corruption Bureau, which we adopted the law in 2014 and took us approximately one and a half years to launch a new institution, which is very effective. Now, their key focus is to investigate anti-corruption crimes at a high level. But the key thing is, in order to complete it, these cases need to be judged.
So the country is still in the middle of a funding program with the International Monetary Fund.
What do you mean still is? We're planning to complete it by the end of 2019.
Well,
this is our plan.
That leads me to my next question. In that case, what's the need to tap private markets? Because a couple of weeks ago, you issued a bond.
Yes.
And I think some people certainly are saying, you know, why does Ukraine need to tap private markets if it's already got a funding arrangement with the IMF?
Oh, because they are totally different, these sources, right? The money that we receive from IMF, the tranches, they go to support our currency. Mm-hmm. They go to the national bank reserves, mm-hmm. right? And the bonds that we place on the market, they go to finance the budget, mm-hmm. budget deficit. And so actually, this bond issue was fully envisaged by the program. By the way, next 2 years, we have in the program some benchmarks that next year we'll raise 2 billion and year after another 2 billion.
In private markets?
In private markets. So by the end of the program, we need to be present actively in the market and we need to raise some additional capital. Why? It's because this program was structured moving from point A to B. In 2018, we need to be self-sufficient, right? We need to be very strong, growing economy and stable financial system. Mm-hmm. And being on the markets is essential part of it.
I suppose the criticism that has been levied at Ukraine is that now that the economy is quite stable, you know, you're running a budget surplus, your current account is looking pretty good, GDP growth is pretty good. You're able now to, in a sense, ignore the recommendations of the IMF and go to private markets instead. And the fears, I think, is that the sort of momentum behind reform has slowed down as a result of that.
Can I tell that this is very artificial? We own the reform agenda. We're driving the country forward. IMF supports us. It's a joint program, right? So they support the reforms that we're doing and some other reforms, by the way, which are not in the program, like healthcare reform, which we're going to launch next week. And if we're progressing within this agenda, it means that we're within IMF program. If we don't do reforms, then somehow we're not in IMF, right? But we also stop doing reforms. Yeah. And this is where the government cannot afford this because people expect us to change the country. September already just finished. So what we had? Education reform and pension reform passed. And by the way, changes to the judiciary reform. For 1 month, three reforms that other countries actually adopting years. And at the same time, we're working on the budget, amending some other laws which are crucially important, including for the reintegration of the Donbass region. So this is a lot on the table. So I'm just wondering, where can you find even a minute to say, listen, we have time now to relax. I don't see it in my life.
So with all these reforms that you've outlined in detail, I mean, are there kind of internal forces within Ukraine, are there internal factions that are presumably feel quite threatened by this and will try their best to slow down these reforms, right? I mean, what are they trying to do at the moment?
They're trying to slow it down. We initiated the changes to the VAT administration, refund administration process.
When you export stuff and you get a VAT refund,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay, VAT refunds was the number one area for corruption in the state fiscal service.
This would be the idea where you'd pretend to export something
and
then claim back the VAT?
Actually, there are two parts. First is the company that really exported, they want to get the VAT refund. And they couldn't do it because it was delayed for months, right? And only those who either, have some special entrance or agree to pay would receive the refund. And that was the reality for so many years. In January, we introduced a transparent VAT registered on our website. And then another example is that you mentioned is that some fake VAT. The first VAT refunds, it's money stolen from the business. The fake VAT is the money stolen from the budget. But both are very bad for the business climate and for the financial system, right? So we address these two. First is the VAT refunds. We introduced new system in January, February, and a special system that fights fake VAT we introduced in July. So now this measure saved billions for the business and for the budget. Obviously, somebody lost this money. So they're trying through the parliament to fight it back, using some strange excuses that we need to support business. There is a very strong position of our ministry, from the prime minister, from the business association, saying, we will not allow, reversing on the path of reforms. We as a country need to move forward. We cannot afford wasting the time on revision of the already taken steps. We need to move forward. Then we will be successful.
Okay, Minister, thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Alexander Danieliuk and Callum Williams there. Finally,
the Barclays mobile banking app.
The Santander app lets you bank.
Fast balance on your mobile from HSBC.
Mobile and internet banking are steadily usurping the services of physical branches as banks, like most other services, adapt to the digital age. But some banks are transforming more than their competitors. So is it paying off? Our banking editor, Patrick Lane, is here to discuss. So, Patrick, your piece in this week's issue focuses on the Spanish bank, BBVA. Why?
Well, Phil, BBVA talks an awful lot about its digital transformation, and it has done for some years. So I thought it was a bank that would be worth looking at a bit more closely. It's led by a man called Francisco González Rodríguez, who's been the executive chairman of the bank since it was formed in a merger in around 1999 or 2000. And he was a computer programmer by trade before he ever entered the financial services world. A lot of people near the top of the bank are, you might say, primarily computer people or software people rather than bankers. And the way in which they've tried to reorganize themselves, not just in terms of the products they present to customers, but also the way they organize themselves inside the bank, is really quite interesting. They were quite early to do it.
And are they at the forefront of digital adoption, or are there even whizzier banks in the US which are ahead of them?
There are certainly whizzier banks, because there's a whole crop of banks, partly in the US, but perhaps more so in Europe, which were born digital. So there's a lot of banks in this country. There are a few in Germany, which have been digital from the outset and have completely dispensed with branches. BBVA was pretty early, certainly, to start transforming itself digitally, both with its internal processes and the way it thinks about producing new products. It's certainly not the only one. I mean, there are others. ING, which is a Dutch bank, is talked about quite a lot. So is Commerzbank in Germany. So are various others. BBVA seems to walk the walk better than most.
And does it pay off? I mean, in other industries, we've seen every business move to online services, and yet the price falls along with their cost base. Is BBVA profiting from this change?
Eventually, all this investment and all the ways in which it's reorganizing itself have to come through either in lower costs or higher revenues or lower risk. There's some evidence on the cost side, because if you look at its cost income ratio, it's a little bit, it's lower, clearly lower than that of the other leading Spanish banks, but not so spectacularly lower that you'd say it's all done and dusted. On the revenue side, you're seeing products that are beginning to come through that people are using. For example, there's a little sort of insurance product you can buy in Colombia if you take money out of a cash machine there, which insures you against being robbed for the next few hours. But of course, that only brings in a few cents a time. They are concentrating very, very hard on getting products out very quickly. So you get a team together within a few days, you get a prototype together within 6 weeks, you're meant to have a product ready for the customer's hands within 9 months. You can't do absolutely everything at that speed, of course. But it seems to be taking time to come through into revenues, and that could be because it's early days yet. When you talk to analysts about the bank, they are very impressed with what they're doing on the technical side, but they do want to see more evidence that it's coming through into revenue.
Thank you very much, Patrick. That's all for this episode of Money Talks. To read more about everything discussed in the show, pick up the forthcoming issue of The Economist or visit our website at economist.com. And please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. I'm Philip Coggan. In London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.